He wasn't Fred, he was Charles.
It's not natural.
The more she thought about it, the more she wished she had been there. It was like a pain in the heart. The thought that no one at the inquest was interested. The second cousin stayed in Middlesbrough. His counsel asked no questions, and Fred's own paper only gave him half a column. On the front page was another photograph. The new Collie Kibber. He was going to be at Bournemouth tomorrow. They might have waited, she thought, a week. It would have shown respect.
I'd like to have asked them why he left me like that, to go scampering down the front in that sun.
He had his job to do. He had to leave those cards.
Why did he tell me he'd wait?
Ah, the sombre man said. You'd have to ask him that. And at the words, it was almost as if he was trying to answer her. Answer her in his own kind of hieroglyphics, in the obscure pain, speaking in her nerves as a ghost would have to speak. Ida believed in ghosts.
There's a lot he'd say if he could, she said.
She took up the paper again and read slowly.
He did his job to the end, she said tenderly.
She liked men who did their jobs. There was a kind of vitality about it. He dropped his cards all the way down the front. They'd come back to the office from under a boat, from a litter basket, a child's pail. He had only a few left when Mr. Alfred Jefferson, described as a chief clerk of Clapham, found him.
If he did kill himself, she said.
She was the only counsel to represent the dead.
He did his job first.
But he didn't kill himself, Clarence said. You've only got to read. They cut him up and they say he died natural.
That's queer, Ida said. He went and left one in a restaurant. I knew he was hungry, kept on wanting to eat, but whatever made him slip away like that all by himself and leave me waiting? It sounds crazy.
I suppose he changed his mind about you, Ida.
I don't like it, Ida said. It sounds strange to me. I wish I'd been there. I'd have asked him a few questions.
What about you and me going across to the Flickers, Ida?
I'm not in the mood, Ida said. It's not every day you lose a friend. And you oughtn't to be in the mood either with your wife just dead.
She's been gone a month now, Clarence said. You can't expect anyone to go on mourning forever.
A month's not so long, Ida said sadly, brooding over the paper.
A day, she thought. That's all he's been gone, and I dare say there's not another soul but me thinking about him. Just someone he picked up for a drink and a cuddle. And again the easy pathos touched her friendly and popular heart. She wouldn't have given it all another thought if there had been other relations besides the second cousin in Middlesbrough, if he hadn't been so alone as well as dead. But there was something fishy to her nose, though there was nothing she could put her finger on except that Fred. And everyone would say the same. He wasn't Fred. You've only to read Charles Hale. You oughtn't to fuss about that, Ida. It's none of your business.
I know, she said. It's none of mine.
But it's none of anybody's, her heart repeated to her. That was the trouble. No one but her to ask questions. She knew a woman once who'd seen her husband after he was dead, standing by the wireless set trying to twiddle the knob. She twiddled the way he wanted, and he disappeared, and immediately she heard an announcer say on Midland Regional, "Gale warning in the channel." She had been thinking of taking one of the Sunday trips to Calais, that was the point. It just showed. You couldn't laugh at the idea of ghosts. And if Fred, she thought, wanted to tell someone something, it wouldn't be to his second cousin in Middlesbrough that he'd go. Why shouldn't he come to me? He had left her waiting there. She had waited nearly half an hour. Perhaps he wanted to tell her why. He was a gentleman, she said aloud. And with bolder resolution, she cocked her hat and smoothed her hair and rose from the wine barrel. I've got to be going, she said. So long, Clarence.
Where to? I've never known you in such a hurry, Ida, he complained bitterly over the Guinness.
Ida put her finger on the paper.
Someone ought to be there, she said, even if second cousins aren't.
He won't care who's putting him in the ground.
You never know,
Ida said, remembering the ghost by the radio set. It shows respect. Besides, I like a funeral. But he wasn't exactly being put in the ground in the bright new flowery suburb where he had lodged. There were no unhygienic buryings in that place. Two brick towers like those of a Scandinavian town hall, cloisters with little plaques along the walls like school war memorials, a bare cold secular chapel which could be adapted quietly and conveniently to any creed, no cemetery, wax flowers,
impoverished jam pots of wilting wild flowers. Ida was late. Hesitating a moment outside the door for fear the place might be full of Fred's friends, she thought someone had turned on the national program. She knew that cultured, inexpressive voice, but when she opened the door, a man, not a machine, stood up in a black cassock saying, "Heaven." There was nobody there but somebody who looked like a landlady, a servant who had parked a pram outside, two men impatiently whispering. "Our belief in heaven," the clergyman went on, "is not qualified by our disbelief in the old medieval hell. We believe," he said, glancing swiftly along the smooth, polished slipway towards the new art doors through which the coffin would be launched into the flames, "we believe that this, our brother, is already at one with the One." He stamped his words like little pats of butter with his personal mark. "He has attained unity. We do not know what that One is with whom or with which he is now at one. We do not retain the old medieval beliefs in glassy seas and golden crowns. Truth is beauty, and there is more beauty for us, a truth-loving generation, in the certainty that our brother is at this moment reabsorbed in the universal spirit." He touched a little buzzer. The new art doors opened. The flames flapped, and the coffin slid smoothly down into the fiery sea. The doors closed, the nurse rose and made for the door. The clergyman smiled gently from behind the slipway, like a conjurer who has produced his 940th rabbit without a hitch. It was all over. Ida squeezed out with difficulty a last tear into a handkerchief scented with Californian poppy. She liked a funeral, but it was with horror, as other people liked a ghost story. Death shocked her. Life was so important. She wasn't religious. She didn't believe in heaven or hell, only in ghosts, Ouija boards, tables which rapped, and little inept voices speaking plaintively of flowers. Let papists treat death with flippancy. Life wasn't so important perhaps to them as what came after, but to her, death was the end of everything. At one with the One, it didn't mean a thing beside a glass of Guinness on a sunny day. She believed in ghosts, but you couldn't call that thin, transparent existence life eternal. The squeak of a board, a piece of ectoplasm in a glass cupboard at the psychical research headquarters, a voice she'd heard once at a seance saying, "Everything is very beautiful on the upper plane. There are flowers everywhere." Flowers, Ida thought scornfully. That wasn't life. Life was sunlight on brass bedposts, ruby port. The leap of the heart when the outsider you've backed passes the post and the colours go bobbing up. Life was poor Fred's mouth pressed down on hers in the taxi, vibrating with the engine along the parade. What was the sense of dying if it made you babble of flowers? Fred didn't want flowers. He wanted... And the enjoyable distress she had felt in Henneke's returned. She took life with a deadly seriousness. She was prepared to cause any amount of unhappiness to anyone in order to defend the only thing she believed in. To lose your lover, broken hearts, she would say, always mend. To be maimed or blinded, lucky, she'd tell you, to be alive at all. There was something dangerous and remorseless in her optimism, whether she was laughing in Henneke's or weeping at a funeral or a marriage. She came out of the crematorium, and there from the twin towers above her head fumed the very last of Fred, a thin stream of grey smoke from the ovens. People passing up the flowery suburban road looked up and noted the smoke. It had been a busy day at the furnaces. Fred dropped in indistinguishable grey ash on the pink blossoms. He became part of the smoke nuisance over London. And Ida wept. But while she wept, a determination grew. It grew all the way to the tram lines which would lead her back to her familiar territory, to the bars and the electric signs and the variety theatres. Man is made by the places in which he lives, and Ida's mind worked with the simplicity and the regularity of a sky sign, the ever-tipping glass, the ever-revolving wheel, the plain question flashing on and off, "Do you use forums for the gums?" "I'd do as much for Tom," she thought, "for Clarence,
That old deceitful ghost in Henneke's, for Harry? It's the least you can do for anyone. Ask questions, questions at inquests, questions at seances. Somebody had made Fred unhappy, and somebody was going to be made unhappy in turn. An eye for an eye. If you believed in God, you might leave vengeance to him, but you couldn't trust the one, the universal spirit. Vengeance was Ida's, just as much as reward was Ida's, the soft, gluey mouth affixed in taxis, the warm hand clasp in cinemas, the only reward there was. And vengeance and reward, they both were fun. The train tingled and sparked down the embankment. If it was a woman who had made Fred unhappy, she'd tell her what she thought. If Fred had killed himself, she'd find it out. The papers would print the news. Someone would suffer. Ida was going to begin at the beginning and work right on. She was a sticker. The first stage, she had held the paper in her hand all through the service, was Molly Pink, described as a private secretary employed by Messrs. Carter and Galloway. Ida came up from Charing Cross Station into the hot and windy light in the Strand flickering on the carburettors. In an upper room of Stanley Gibbons, a man with a long grey Edwardian moustache sat in a window examining a postage stamp through a magnifying glass. A great dray laden with barrels stamped by, and the fountains played in Trafalgar Square, a cool translucent flower blooming and dropping into the drab sooty basins. "It'll cost money," Ida repeated to herself. "It always costs money if you want to know the truth." And she walked slowly up St. Martin's Lane, calculating, while all the time beneath the melancholy and the resolution, her heart beat faster to the refrain. "It's exciting. It's fun. It's living." In Seven Dials, the Negroes were hanging round the public house doors in tight, natty suitings and old school ties, and Ida recognized one of them and passed the time of day. "How's business, Joe?" The great white teeth went on like a row of lights in the darkness above the bright striped shirt. "Fine, Ida, fine." "And the hay fever?" "Terrible, Ida, terrible." "So long, Joe." "So long, Ida." It was a quarter of an hour's walk to Messrs. Carter and Galloway, who lived at the very top of a tall building on the outskirts of Gray's Inn. She had to economize now. She wouldn't even take a bus, and when she got to the dusty, antiquated building, there wasn't a lift. The long flights of stone stairs wearied Ida. She'd had a long day and nothing to eat but a bun at the station. She sat down on a windowsill and took off her shoes. Her feet were hot. She wiggled her toes. An old gentleman came down. He had a long moustache and a sidelong, raffish look. He wore a check coat, a yellow waistcoat, and a grey bowler. He took off his bowler.
"In distress, madam?"
he asked, peering down at Ida with little bleary eyes.
"Be of assistance?"
"I don't allow anyone else to scratch my toes," Ida said.
"Ha ha,"
the old gentleman said.
"A card, after my own heart. Up or down?"
"Up, all the way to the top."
"Carter and Galloway, good firm. Tell them I sent you."
"What's your name?"
"Moyne. Charlie Moyne. Seen you here before?"
"Never."
"Someplace else. Never forget fine figure of a woman. Tell them Moyne sent you. Give you special terms."
"Why don't they have a lift in this place?"
"Old-fashioned people." "Old-fashioned myself. Seen you at Epsom."
"You might have."
"Always tell a sporting woman. Ask you round the corner to split a bottle of fizz if those beggars hadn't taken the last fiver I came out with. Wanted to go and lay a couple. Have to go home first. Odds will go down while I'm doing it. You'll see. You couldn't oblige me, I suppose. 2 quid. Charlie Moyne."
The bloodshot eyes watched her without hope. A little aloof and careless, the buttons on the yellow waistcoat stirred as the old heart hammered. "Here," Ida said. "You can have a quid. Now run along."
"Awfully kind of you. Give me your card. Post you a check tonight."
"I haven't got a card," Ida said.
"Came out without mine, too. Never mind. Charlie Moyne, care of Carter and Galloway, all know me here."
"That's all right," Ida said. "I'll see you again. I've got to be going on up."
"Take my arm,"
he helped her up.
"Tell him Moyne sent you. Special terms."
She looked back at the turn of the stairs.
He was tucking the pound note away in his waistcoat, smoothing the moustache, which was still golden at the tips like a cigarette smoker's fingers, setting his bowler at an angle. Poor old geezer, Ida thought. He never expected to get that, watching him go down the stairs in his jaunty and ancient despair. There were only two doors on the top landing. She opened one marked Inquiries, and there, without a doubt, was Molly Pink. In a little room hardly larger than a broom cupboard, she sat beside a gas ring sucking a sweet. A kettle hissed at Ida as she entered. A swollen, spotty face glared back at her without a word.
"Excuse me," Ida said. "The partners is out."
"I came to see you." The mouth fell a little open. A lump of toffee stirred on the tongue. The kettle whistled.
"Me?"
"Yes," Ida said. "You'd better look out, the kettle will boil over. You are Molly Pink."
"You want a cup?"
The room was lined from floor to ceiling with files. A little window disclosed through the undisturbed dust of many years another block of buildings with the same arrangement of windows staring dustily back like a reflection. A dead fly hung in a broken web.
"I don't like tea," Ida said. "That's lucky, there's only one cup," Molly said, filling a thick brown teapot with a chipped spout.
"A friend of mine called Moyne," Ida began.
"Oh, him," Molly said. "We just turned him out of house and home."
A copy of Woman and Beauty was propped open on her typewriter, and her eyes slid continually back to it.
"Out of house and home?"
"House and home. He came to see the partners. He tried to blarney."
"Did he see them?"
"The partners is out. Have a toffee?"
"It's bad for the figure," Ida said.
"I make up for it. I don't eat breakfast."
Over Molly's head, Ida could see the labels on the files. Rents of 1-6 Mud Lane, rents of Wainage Estate Ballam, rents of... They were surrounded by the pride of ownership, property.
"I came here," Ida said, "because you met a friend of mine."
"Sit down," Molly said. "That's the client's chair. I has to entertain him. Mr. Moyne's not a friend."
"Not Moyne. Someone called Hale."
"I don't want any more to do with that business. You ought to have seen the partners. They was furious. I had to have a day off for the inquest. They kept me hours late next day."
"I just want to hear what happened."
"What happened? The partners is awful when roused."
"I mean about Fred Hale."
"I didn't exactly know him."
"That man you said at the inquest came up."
"It wasn't a man. He was just a kid. He knew Mr. Hale."
"But in the paper it said..."
Oh, Mr. Hale said he didn't know him. I didn't tell them different. They didn't ask me. Except, was there anything odd in his manner?"
"Well, there wasn't anything you'd call odd. He was just scared, that's all. We get lost like that in here."
"But you didn't tell them that?"
"That's nothing uncommon. I knew what it was at once. He owed the kid money. We get lost like that, like Charlie Moyne."
"He was scared, was he? Poor old Fred."
"I'm not Fred," he said. "Sharp as you please. But I could tell all right. So could my friend."
"What was the kid like?"
"Oh, just a kid.
Tall?"
"Not particularly."
"Fair?"
"I couldn't say that."
"How old was he?"
"About my age, I'd say."
"What's that?"
18,
Molly said, staring defiantly across the typewriter and the steaming kettle, sucking a toffee.
"Did he ask for money?" "He didn't have time to ask for money."
"You didn't notice anything else?"
"He was awful anxious for me to go along with him, but I couldn't, not with my friend there."
"Thanks," Ida said. "Is something learnt?"
"You a woman detective?" Molly asked.
"Oh, no, I'm just a friend of his." There was something fishy. She was convinced of it now. She remembered again how scared he'd been in the taxi, and going down Holborn towards her digs behind Russell Square in the late afternoon sun, she thought again of the way in which he had handed her the 10 shillings before she went down into the ladies. He was a real gentleman. Perhaps it was the last few shillings he had. And those people, that boy, dunning him for money. Perhaps he was another one ruined like Charlie Moyne, and now that her memory of his face was getting a bit dim, she couldn't help lending him a few of Charlie Moyne's features, the bloodshot eyes, if nothing else. Sporting gentleman, free-handed gentleman. Real gentleman. The dewlaps of the commercials drooped in the hall of the Imperial. The sun lay flat across the plane trees, and a bell rang and rang for tea in a boarding house in Coram Street. I'll try the board, Ida thought. And then I'll know. When she got in, there was a card on the hall table, a card of Brighton Pier. If I was superstitious, she thought, if I was superstitious. She turned it over. It was only from Phil Corkery asking her to come down. She had the same every year from Eastbourne, Hastings, and once from Aberystwyth. But she never went. He wasn't someone she liked to encourage. Too quiet. Not what she called a man. She went to the basement stairs and called Old Crow. She needed two sets of fingers for the board, and she knew it would give the old man pleasure. "Old Crow," she called, peering down the stone stairs. "Old Crow!"
"What is it, Ida?"
"I'm going to have a turn at the board." She didn't wait for him, but went on up to her bed sitting room to make ready. The room faced east, and the sun had gone. It was cold and dusk. Ida turned on the gas fire and drew the old scarlet velvet curtains to shut out the grey sky and the chimney pots. Then she patted the divan bed into shape and drew two chairs to the table. In a glass-fronted cupboard, her life stared back at her. A good life. Pieces of china bought at the seaside, a photograph of Tom and Edgar Wallace, Annetta Syrett from a second-hand stall, some sheets of music, the good companions, her mother's picture, more china, a few jointed animals made of wood and elastic, trinkets given her by this, that and the other, Sorrel and Son. The board. She took the board gently down and locked the cupboard. A flat oval piece of polished wood on tiny wheels, it looked like something which had crept out of a cupboard in a basement kitchen. But in fact it was Old Crow who had done that, knocking gently on the door, sidling in, white hair, grey face, short-sighted pit-pony eyes, blinking at the bare globe in Ida's reading lamp. Ida tossed a pink netty scarf over the light and dimmed it for him.
"You got something to ask it, Ida?"
Old Crow said. He shivered a little, frightened and fascinated. Ida sharpened a pencil and inserted it in the prow of the little board.
"Sit down, Old Crow. What have you been doing all day?"
"They had a funeral at 27. One of those Indian students."
"I've been to a funeral too. Was yours a good one?"
"There aren't any good funerals these days, not with plumes."
Ida gave the little board a push. It slid sideways across the polished table more than ever like a beetle.
"The pencil's too long,"
Old Crow said. He sat, hugging his hands between his knees, bent forward watching the board. Ida screwed the pencil a little higher.
"Past or future?"
Old Crow asked, panting a little.
"I want to get in touch today," Ida said.
"Dead or alive?"
Old Crow said.
"Dead. I've seen him burnt this afternoon, cremated. Come on, Old Crow, put your fingers on."
"Better take off your rings,"
Old Crow said.
"Gold confuses it."
Ida unclothed her fingers, laid the tips on the board, which squeaked away from her across the sheet of foolscap.
"Come on, Old Crow," she said.
Old Crow giggled. He said,
"It's naughty,"
and placed his bony digits on the very rim where they throbbed a tiny nervous tattoo.
"What are you going to ask it, Ida?"
"Are you there, Fred?"
The board squeaked away under their fingers, drawing long lines across the paper this way and that.
"It's got a will of its own," Ida said.
"Hush,"
said Old Crow. The board bucked a little with its hind wheel and came to a stop.
"We might look now," Ida said.
She pushed the board to one side and they stared together at the network of penciling.
"You might make out a Y there," Ida said.
"Or it might be an N."
"Anyway, something's there. We'll try again."
She put her fingers firmly on the board.
"What happened to you, Fred?"
And immediately the board was off and away. All her indomitable will worked through her fingers. She wasn't going to have any nonsense this time. And across the board, the grey face of Old Crow frowned with concentration.
"It's writing. Real letters," Ida said with triumph,
and as her own fingers momentarily loosened their grip, she could feel the board slide firmly away as if on another's errand.
"Hush,"
said Old Crow, but it bucked and stopped. They pushed the board away, and there, unmistakably, in large, thin letters, was a word, but not a word they knew. Sukil.
"Looks like a name,"
Old Crow said. Must mean something, Ida said. The board always means something. We'll try again. And again the wooden beetle scampered off, drawing its tortuous trail. The globe burnt red under the scarf, and Old Crow whistled between his teeth. Now, Ida said, and lifted the board. A long, ragged word ran diagonally across the paper. Fresuicillae.
Well,
Old Crow said,
that's a mouthful. You can't make anything of that, Ida.
Can't I, though? Ida said. Why, it's clear as clear. Fre is short for Fred, and suicide for suicide, and I, that's what I always say, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
What about those two L's?
I don't know yet, but I'll bear them in mind. She leant back in her chair with a sense of power and triumph. I'm not superstitious, she said, but you can't get over that. The board knows.
She knows,
Old Crow said, sucking his teeth. One more try. The board slid and squeaked and abruptly stopped. Clear as clear, the name stared up at her. Phil. Well, Ida said. Well. She blushed a little. Like a sugar biscuit.
Thank you, Ida. Thank you, Ida.
Ida took a tin out of the cupboard drawer and pushed it over to Old Crow. They drove him to death, Ida said happily. I knew there was something fishy. See that eye? That as good as tells me what to do. Her eye lingered on Phil. I'm going to make those people sorry they was ever born. She drew in her breath luxuriously and stretched her monumental legs. Right and wrong, she said. I believe in right and wrong. And delving a little deeper with a sigh of happy satiety, she said, it's going to be exciting. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a bit of life, Old Crow. Giving the highest praise she could give to anything, while the old man sucked his tooth and the pink light wavered on the Warwick Deeping. Part 2 Chapter 1 The boy stood with his back to Spicer, staring out across the dark wash of sea. They had the end of the pier to themselves. Everyone else at that hour and in that weather was in the concert hall. The lightning went on and off above the horizon, and the rain dripped. "Where've you been?" the boy asked.
"Walking around,"
Spicer said. "You been there?"
I wanted to see it was all safe, that there wasn't anything you'd forgotten.
The boy said slowly, leaning out across the rail into the doubtful rain. When people do one murder, I've read they sometimes have to do another. To tidy up. The word murder conveyed no more to him than the word box, collar, giraffe. He said, Spicer, you keep away from there. The imagination hadn't awoken. That was his strength. He couldn't see through other people's eyes or feel with their nerves. Only the music made him uneasy, the catgut vibrating in the heart. It was like nerves losing their freshness. It was like age coming on, other people's experience battering on the brain. Where are the rest of the mob?
In Sam's drinking.
Why aren't you drinking too?
I'm not thirsty, Pinky. I wanted some fresh air. This thunder makes you feel queer.
Why don't they stop that bloody noise in there? The boy said.
You're not going to Sam's?
I've got a job of work to do, the boy said.
It's all right, Pinky, ain't it? After that verdict, it's all right. Nobody asks questions.
I just want to be sure, the boy said.
The mob won't stand for any more killing.
Who said there was going to be any killing? The lightning flared up and showed his tight, shabby jacket, the bunch of soft hair at the nape. I've got a date, that's all. You be careful what you say, Spicer. You aren't milky, are you?
I'm not milky. You got me wrong, Pinky. I just don't want another killing. That verdict sort of shook us all. What did they mean by it? We did kill him, Pinky.
We got to go on being careful, that's all.
What did they mean by it, though? I don't trust the doctors. A break like that's too good.
We got to be careful.
What's that in your pocket, Pinky?
I don't carry a gun, the boy said. You're fancying things. In the town, a clock struck 11. 3 strokes were lost in the thunder coming down across the channel. "You'd better be off," the boy said. "She's late already."
"You've got a razor there, Pinky."
"I don't need a razor with a polony. If you want to know what it is, it's a bottle."
"You don't drink, Pinky."
"Nobody would want to drink this."
"What is it, Pinky?"
"Vitriol," the boy said. "It scares a polony more than a knife." He turned impatiently away from the sea and complained again. "That music." It moaned in his head in the hot electric night. It was the nearest he knew to sorrow, just as a faint, secret, sensual pleasure he felt touching the bottle of vitriol with his fingers as Rose came hurrying by the concert hall was his nearest approach to passion. "Get out," he said to Spicer. "She's here."
"Oh," Rose said. "I'm late. I've run all the way," she said. "I thought you must have thought..."
"I'd have waited," the boy said.
"It was an awful night in the cafe," the girl said. "Everything went wrong. I broke 2 plates and the cream was sour."
It all came out in a breath.
"Who is your friend?"
she asked, peering into the darkness.
"You don't matter," the boy said. "I thought somehow... I couldn't see properly."
"He don't matter," the boy repeated.
"What are we going to do?"
"Well, I thought we'd talk a little here first," the boy said. "And then go on somewhere. Sherry's? I don't care."
"I'd love Sherry's," Rose said.
"You got your money yet for that card?"
"Yes, I got it this morning."
"Nobody came and asked you questions?"
"Oh, no. But wasn't it dreadful, his being dead like that?"
"You saw his photograph." Rose came close to the rail and peered palely up at the boy.
"But it wasn't him. That's what I don't understand."
"People look different in photographs."
"I've got a memory for faces. It wasn't him. They must have cheated. You can't trust the newspapers."
"Come here," the boy said. He drew her round the corner until they were a little farther from the music, more alone with the lightning on the horizon and the thunder coming closer. "I like you," the boy said, an unconvincing smile forking his mouth. "And I want to warn you. This fellow Hale, I've heard a lot about him. He got himself mixed up with things."
"What sort of things?"
Rose whispered. "Never mind what things," the boy said. "Only I'd warn you for your own good. You've got the money. If I were you, I'd forget it. Forget all about that fellow who left the card. He's dead, see? You've got the money. That's all that matters."
"Anything you say," Rose said.
"You can call me Pinky, if you like. That's what my friends call me."
"Pinky,"
Rose repeated, trying it shyly out as the thunder cracked overhead. "You read about Peggy Barron, didn't you?"
"No, Pinky."
"It was in all the papers."
"I didn't see any papers till I got this job. We couldn't afford papers at home."
"She got mixed up with the mob," the boy said, "and people came asking her questions. It's not safe."
"I wouldn't get mixed up with a mob like that," Rose said.
"You can't always help it. It sort of comes that way."
"What happened to her?"
Rose said. "They spoiled her looks. She lost one eye. They splashed vitriol on her face." Rose whispered,
"Vitriol? What's vitriol?"
And the lightning showed a strut of tarred wood, a wave breaking in her pale, bony, terrified face. "You never seen vitriol?" the boy said, grinning through the dark. He showed her the little bottle. "That's vitriol." He took the cork out and spilled a little on the wooden plank of the pier. It hissed like steam. "It burns," the boy said. "Smell it." And he thrust the bottle under her nose. She gasped at him.
"Pinky, you wouldn't..."
"And I was pulling your leg," he smoothly lied to her.
"That's not vitriol, that's just spirit.
I wanted to warn you, that's all. You and me's going to be friends. I don't want a friend with her skin burned off. You tell me if anyone asks questions."
"Anyone, mind.
Get me on the blower at Frank's straight off. 3 6s, you can remember that." He took her arm and propelled her away from the lonely pier end, back by the lit concert hall, the music drifting landwards, grief in the guts.
"Pinky," she said, "I wouldn't want to interfere. I don't interfere in anyone's business. I've never been nosy, cross my heart."
"You're a good kid," he said. You know an awful lot about things, Pinky, she said with horror and admiration. And suddenly at the stale romantic tune the orchestra was playing, lovely to look at, beautiful to hold, and heaven itself, a little venom of anger and hatred came out on the boy's lips. You've got to know a lot, he said, if you get around. Come on, we'll go to Sherry's. Once off the pier, they had to run for it. Taxis splashed them with water. The strings of coloured bulbs down the Hove Parade gleamed like pools of petrol through the rain. They shook the water off onto the floor of Sherry's, and Rose saw the queue waiting all the way upstairs for the gallery. It's full, she said with disappointment. We'll go on the floor, the boy said, paying his 3 shillings as carelessly as if he always went there, and walked out among the little tables, the dancing partners with bright metallic hair and little black bags, while the coloured lights flashed green and pink and blue. Rose said, It's lovely here. Reminds me... And all the way to their table she counted over aloud all the things of which it reminded her. The lights, the tune the band was playing, the crowd on the floor trying to rumber. She had an immense store of trivial memories, and when she wasn't living in the future, she was living in the past. As for the present, she got through that as quickly as she could, running away from things, running towards things, so that her voice was always a little breathless, her heart pounding at an escape or an expectation. I whipped the plate under the apron, and she said, Rose, what are you hiding there? And a moment later she was turning wide, unfledged eyes back to the boy with a look of the deepest admiration, the most respectful hope. What'll you drink? The boy said. She didn't even know the name of a drink. In Nelson Place, from which she had emerged like a mole into the daylight of Snow's restaurant on the Palace Pier, she had never known a boy with enough money to offer her a drink. She would have said beer, but she had had no opportunity of discovering whether she liked beer. A tuppenny ice from an Everest tricycle was the whole extent of her knowledge of luxury. She goggled hopelessly at the boy. He asked her sharply, What do you like? I don't know what you like. An ice, she said with disappointment, but she couldn't keep him waiting. What kind of an ice? Just an ordinary ice, she said. Everest hadn't in all the slum years offered her a choice. Vanilla, the waiter said. She nodded. She supposed that that was what she had always had, and so it proved, only a size larger. Otherwise she might just as well have been sucking it between wafers by a tricycle. You're a soft sort of kid, the boy said. How old are you? I'm 17, she said defiantly. There was a law which said a man couldn't go with you before you were 17. I'm 17 too, the boy said. And the eyes which had never been young stared with grey contempt into the eyes which had only just begun to learn a thing or two. He said, Do you dance? And she replied humbly, I haven't danced much. It don't matter, the boy said. I'm not one for dancing. He eyed the slow movement of the two-backed beasts. Pleasure, he thought. They call it pleasure. He was shaken by a sense of loneliness, an awful lack of understanding. The floor was cleared for the last cabaret of the evening. A spotlight picked out a patch of floor, a crooner in a dinner jacket, a microphone on a long black movable stand. He held it tenderly as if it were a woman, swinging it gently this way and that, wooing it with his lips, while from the loudspeaker under the gallery his whisper reverberated hoarsely over the hall, like a dictator announcing victory, like the official news following a long censorship. It gets you, the boy said. It gets you, surrendering himself to the huge, brazen suggestion. Music talks, talks of our love. The starling on our walks talks, talks of our love. The taxis tooting, the last owl hooting, the tube train rumbling, busy bee bumbling, talk of our love. Music talks, talks of our love. The west wind on our walks talks, talks of our love. The nightingale singing, the postman ringing, electric drill groaning, office telephoning, talk of our love. The boy stared at the spotlight. Music, love, nightingale, postman. The words stirred in his brain like poetry. One hand caressed the vitriol bottle in his pocket, the other touched Rose's wrist. The inhuman voice whistled round the gallery and the boy sat silent. It was he this time who was being warned. Life held the vitriol bottle and warned him, "I'll spoil your looks." It spoke to him in the music, and when he protested that he for one would never get mixed up, the music had its own retort at hand. You can't always help it. It sort of comes that way. The watchdog on our walks talks, talks of our love. The crowd stood at attention 6 deep behind the tables. There wasn't enough room on the floor for so many. They were dead quiet. It was like the anthem on Armistice Day when the king has deposited his wreath, the hats off, and the troops turned to stone. It was love of a kind, music of a kind, truth of a kind they listened to. Gracie Fields funning, the gangsters gunning, talk of our love. The music pealed on under the Chinese lanterns, and the pink spotlight featured the singer holding the microphone closer to his starched shirt. "You been in love?" the boy asked sharply and uneasily.
"Oh, yes," Rose said.
The boy retorted with sudden venom. "You would have been. You're green. You don't know what people do." The music came to an end, and in the silence he laughed aloud. "You're innocent." People turned in their chairs and looked at them. A girl giggled. His fingers pinched her wrist. "You're green," he said again. He was working himself into a little sensual rage, as he had done with the soft kids at the council school. "You don't know anything," he said with contempt in his nails.
"Oh, no," she protested. "I know a lot."
The boy grinned at her.
"Not a thing,"
pinching the skin of her wrist until his nails nearly met.
"You like me for your boy, eh?
Well, keep company."
"Oh," she said, "I'd love it."
Tears of pride and pain pricked behind her lids.
"If you like doing that," she said, "go on."
The boy let go.
"That'd be soft," he said. "Why should I like it? You think you know too much?" he complained.
He sat there, anger like a live coal in his belly as the music came on again. All the good times he'd had in the old days with nails and splinters. The tricks he'd learnt later with a razor blade. What would be the fun if people didn't squeal? He said furiously,
"We'll be going. I can't stand this place."
And obediently Rose began to pack her handbag, putting back her Woolworth compact and a handkerchief.
"What's that?"
the boy said when something clinked in her bag. She showed him the end of a string of beads.
"You a Roman?"
the boy asked.
"Yes,"
Rose said.
"I'm one too,"
the boy said. He gripped her arm and pushed her out into the dark, dripping street. He turned up the collar of his jacket and ran as the lightning flapped and the thunder filled the air. They ran from doorway to doorway until they were back on the parade in one of the empty glass shelters. They had it to themselves in the noisy, stifling night.
"Why, I was in a choir once," the boy confided. And suddenly he began to sing softly in his spoilt boy's voice.
"Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi, dona nobis pacem." In his voice a whole lost world moved. The lighted corner below the organ, the smell of incense and laundered surplices, and the music. Music. It didn't matter what music. Agnus Dei, lovely to look at, beautiful to hold, the starling on our walks, credo in unum dominum, any music moved him. Speaking of things he didn't understand.
"Do you go to mass?" he asked.
"Sometimes," Rose said. "It depends on work. Most weeks I wouldn't get much sleep if I went to mass."
"I don't care what you do,"
the boy said sharply.
"I don't go to mass."
"But you believe, don't you?"
Rose implored him.
"You think it's true?"
"Of course it's true," the boy said. "What else could there be?"
he went scornfully on.
"Why," he said, "it's the only thing that fits. These atheists, they don't know nothing. Of course there's hell. Flames and damnation,"
he said with his eyes on the dark shifting water and the lightning and the lamps going out above the black struts of the palace pier.
"Torments,"
And heaven, too, Rose said with anxiety while the rain fell interminably on.
Oh, maybe, the boy said. Maybe.
Wet to the skin, the trousers sticking to his thin legs, the boy went up the long, unmatted flight to his bedroom at Frank's. The banister shook under his hand, and when he opened the door and found the mob there, sitting on his brass bedstead, smoking, he said furiously,
"Where's that banister going to be mended? It's not safe. Someone will take a fall one day."
The curtain wasn't drawn, the window was open, and the last lightning flapped across the grey roof stretching to the sea. The boy went to his bed and swept off the crumbs of Cubitt's sausage roll.
"What's this?" he said.
"A meeting?"
"There's trouble about the subscriptions, Pinky,"
Cubitt said.
"There's two not come in, Brewer and Tate. They say now Kite's dead."
"Do we carve them up, Pinky?"
Dallow asked. Spicer stood at the window watching the storm. He said nothing, staring out at the flames and chasms of the sky.
"Ask Spicer," the boy said. "He's been doing a lot of thinking lately."
They all turned and watched Spicer. Spicer said,
"Maybe we ought to lay off a while. You know, a lot of the boys cleared out when Kite got killed."
"Go on,"
the boy said.
"Listen to him. He's what they call a philosopher."
"Well," Spicer said angrily, "there's free speech in this mob, ain't there? Those that cleared out, they didn't see how a kid could run this show."
The boy sat on the bed watching him with his hands in his damp pockets. He shivered once.
"I was always against murder," Spicer said. "I don't care who knows it."
"Sour and milky," the boy said. Spicer came into the middle of the room.
"Listen, Pinky," he said, "be reasonable."
He appealed to them all.
"Be reasonable."
"There's things in what he says,"
Cubitt suddenly put in.
"We had a lucky break. We don't want to draw attention to ourselves. We'd better let Brewer and Tate be for a while."
The boy got up. A few crumbs stuck to his wet suit.
"You ready, Dallow?" he said.
"What you say, Pinky?"
Dallow said, grinning like a large friendly dog.
"Where you going, Pinky?"
Spicer asked.
"I'm going to see Brewer."
Cubitt said,
"You act as if it was last year we killed Hale, not last week. We've got to act cautious."
"That's over and done," the boy said. "You heard the verdict. Natural causes," he said,
looking out at the dying storm.
"You forget that girl in Snows. She could hang us."
"I'm looking after the girl. She won't talk."
"You're marrying her, aren't you?"
Cubitt said. Dallow laughed. The boy's hands came out of his pockets, the knuckles clenched white. He said,
"Who told you I was marrying her?"
"Spicer,"
Cubitt said. Spicer backed away from the boy. He said,
"Listen, Pinky, I only said it as it would make her safe. A wife can't give evidence."
"I don't need to marry a squirt to make her safe. How do we make you safe, Spicer?" His tongue came out between his teeth, licking the edges of his dry, cracked lips. "If carving'd do it."
"It was just a joke,"
Cubitt said.
"You don't need to take it so solemn. You want a sense of humour, Pinky."
"You think that was funny, eh?"
the boy said.
"Me? Marrying? That cheap polony?"
He croaked, "Ha, ha," at them.
"I'll learn."
"Come on, Dallow."
"Wait till morning," Cubitt said. "Wait till some of the other boys come in."
"You milky too?"
"You don't believe that, Pinky, but we got to go slow."
"You with me, Dallow?"
the boy asked.
"I'm with you, Pinky."
"Then we'll be going,"
the boy said. He went across to the washstand and opened the little door where the jerry stood. He felt at the back behind the jerry and pulled out a tiny blade like the blades women shave with, but blunt along one edge and mounted with sticking plaster. He stuck it under his long thumbnail, the only nail not bitten close, and drew on his glove. He said, "We'll be back with the sub in half an hour," and led the way bang straight down Frank's stairs. The cold of his drenching had got under his skin. He came out onto the front a pace ahead of Dallow, his face contorted with ague, a shiver twisting the narrow shoulders. He said over his shoulder to Dallow, "We'll go to Brewer's. One lesson will be enough."
What you say, Pinky? Dallow said, plodding after. The rain had stopped. It was low tide, and the shallow edge of the sea scraped far out at the rim of the shingle. A clock struck midnight. Dallow suddenly began to laugh.
What's got you, Dallow?
I was just thinking, Dallow said. You're a grand little geezer, Pinky. Kite was right to take you on. You go straight for things, Pinky.
You're all right, the boy said, staring ahead, the ague wringing his face.
They passed the Cosmopolitan, the lights on here and there all the way up the tall front to the turrets against the clouded moving sky. In snows, when they passed, a single light went out. They turned up the old Stein. Brewer had a house near the tram lines on the Lewis Road, almost under the railway viaduct. He's gone to bed, Dallow said. Pinky rang the bell, holding his finger on the switch. Low, shuttered shops ran off on either hand. A tram went by with nobody in it, labelled Depot Only, ringing and swinging down the empty road, the conductor drowsing on a seat inside, the roof gleaming from the storm. Pinky kept his finger on the bell.
What made Spicer say that, about me marrying? The boy asked.
He just thought we'd close her clapper, Dallow said.
She's not what keeps me awake, the boy said, pressing on the bell.
A light went on upstairs, a window creaked up, and a voice called,
Who's that?
It's me, the boy said. Pinky.
What do you want? Why don't you come round in the morning?
I want to talk to you, Brewer.
I've got nothing to talk about, Pinky, that can't wait.
You better open up, Brewer.
You don't want the mob along here. The old woman's awful sick, Pinky. I don't want any trouble. She's asleep. She hasn't slept for 3 nights.
This'll wake her, the boy said with his finger on the bell.
A slow goods train went by across the viaduct, shaking smoke down into the Lewis Road.
Leave off, Pinky, and I'll open up.
Pinky shivered as he waited, his gloved hand deep in his damp pocket. Brewer opened the door, a stout elderly man in soiled white pyjamas. The bottom button was missing, and the coat swung from the bulging belly and the deep navel.
Come in, Pinky, he said,
and walk quiet. The old woman's bed. I've been worrying my head off. That why you haven't paid your subscription, Brewer? The boy said.
He looked with contempt down the narrow hall, the shell case converted into an umbrella stand, the moth-eaten stag's head bearing on one horn a bowler hat, a steel helmet used for ferns. Kite ought to have got them into better money than this. Brewer had only just graduated from the street corner saloon bar betting, a welsher. It was no good trying to draw more than 10% of his bets. Brewer said,
Come in here and be snug. It's warm in here. What a cold night.
He had a hollow, cheery manner even in pyjamas. He was like a legend on a racing card, the old firm, you can trust Bill Brewer. He lit the gas fire, turned on a stand lamp in a red silk shade with a bobble fringe. The light glowed on a silver-plated biscuit box, a framed wedding group.
Have a spot of scotch? Brewer invited them. You know I don't drink, the boy said.
Ted will,
Brewer said.
I don't mind a spot,
Dallow said. He grinned and said,
Here's how.
We've called for that subscription, Brewer, the boy said.
The man in white pyjamas hissed soda into his glass. His back turned, he watched Pinky in the glass above the sideboard until he caught the other's eye. He said,
I've been worried, Pinky, ever since Kite was croaked.
Well, the boy said.
It's like this, I said to myself, if Kite's mob can't even protect...
He stopped suddenly and listened.
Was that the old woman?
Very faintly from the room above came the sound of coughing. Brewer said,
She's woke up. I gotta go and see her.
You stay here, the boy said, and talk.
She'll want turning.
When we've finished, you can go. Cough, cough, cough. It was like a machine trying to start and failing. Brewer said desperately,
Be human. She won't know where I've got to. I'll only be a minute.
You don't need to be longer than a minute here, the boy said. All we want's what's due to us. £20.
I haven't got it in the house. Honest, I haven't.
That's too bad for you.
The boy drew off his right glove.
It's like this, Pinky. I paid it all out yesterday, to Collione.
What in Jesus' name, the boy said, has Collione to do with it? Brewer went rapidly and desperately on, listening to the cough, cough, cough upstairs.
Be reasonable, Pinky. I can't pay both of you. I'd have been carved if I hadn't paid Collione.
Is he in Brighton?
He's stopping at the Cosmopolitan.
And Tate? Tate's paid Collione too?
That's right, Pinky. He's running the business in a big way.
A big way? It was like an accusation, a reminder of the brass bedstead at Frank's, the crumbs on the mattress. You think I'm finished? The boy said.
Take my advice, Pinky, and go in with Collione.
The boy suddenly drew his hand back and slashed with his razored nail at Brewer's cheek. He struck blood out along the cheekbone.
Don't!
Brewer said.
Don't!
Backing against the sideboard, upsetting the biscuit box.
He said, I've got protection. You be careful. I've got protection.
The boy laughed. Dallow refilled his glass with Brewer's whiskey. The boy said,
look at him.
He's got protection. Dallow took a splash of soda. You want any more? The boy said.
That was just to show you who's protecting you. I can't pay you both, Pinky. God's sake, keep back.
£20 is what we've come for, Brewer.
Collione will have my blood, Pinky.
You needn't worry. We'll protect you.
Cough, 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 went the woman upstairs, and then a faint cry like a sleeping child's.
She's calling me, Brewer said.
£20.
I don't keep my money in here. Let me fetch it.
You go with him, Dallow, the boy said.
I'll wait here.
And he sat down on a straight carved dining room chair and stared out at the mean street, the dustbins along the pavement, the vast shadow of the viaduct. He sat perfectly still with his grey, ancient eyes giving nothing away. A big way. Collione come into it in a big way. He knew there wasn't a soul in the mob he could trust, except perhaps Dallow. That didn't matter. You couldn't make mistakes when you trusted nobody. A cat coasted cautiously round a bin on the pavement, stopped suddenly, crouched back, and in the semi-dark its agate eyes stared up at the boy. Boy and cat, they didn't stir, watching each other until Dallow returned.
I've got the money, Pinky,
Dallow said. The boy turned his head and grinned at Dallow. Suddenly his face was convulsed. He sneezed twice, violently. Overhead, the coughing died away. You won't forget this visit, Dallow said. He added anxiously, you ought to have a spot of whiskey, Pinky. You've caught cold.
I'm all right, the boy said.
He got up. We won't stop and say goodbye. The boy led the way down the middle of the empty road between the tram lines. He said suddenly,
do you think I've finished, Dallow?
You?
Dallow said.
Why, you haven't even begun.
They walked for a while in silence. The water from the gutters dripped on the pavement. Then Dallow spoke.
You worrying about Collione?
I'm not worrying.
Dallow said suddenly,
you're worth a dozen Collionis. The Cosmopolitan, he exclaimed and spat.
Kite thought he'd go in for the automatic machines. He learned different. Now Collione thinks the coast's clear. He's branching out.
He ought to have learned from Hale.
Hale died natural.
Dallow laughed.
Tell that to Spicer.
They turned the corner by the Royal Albion and the sea was with them again. The tide had turned. A movement, a splashing, a darkness. The boy looked suddenly sideways and up at Dallow. He could trust Dallow. Receiving from the ugly and broken face a sense of triumph and companionship and superiority. He felt as a physically weak but cunning schoolboy feels who has attached to himself in an indiscriminating fidelity the strongest boy in the school.
You mug, he said, and pinched Dallow's arm.
It was almost like affection. A light still burned in Frank's, and Spicer was waiting in the hall.
Anything happened?
He asked anxiously. His pale face had come out in spots round the mouth and nose.
What do you think?
The boy said, going upstairs.
We brought the subscription.
Spicer followed him into his bedroom.
There was a call for you just after you'd gone.
Who from?
A girl called Rose.
The boy sat on the bed undoing his shoe.
What does she want?
He asked.
She said while she was out with you, somebody had been in asking for her.
The boy sat still with the shoe in his hand.
Pinky,
Spicer said.
Was it the girl? The girl from Snow's? course it was.
I answered the phone, Pinky.
Did she know your voice?
How do I know, Pinky?
Who was asking for her?
She didn't know. She said, tell you because you wanted to hear.
Pinky, suppose the bogeys have got that far.
The bogeys aren't as smart as all that. The bogeys aren't as smart as that, Pinky said. Maybe it's one of Colleone's men, poking around after their pal Fred. He took off his other shoe. You don't need to turn milky, Spicer.
It was a woman, Pinky.
I'm not troubling. Fred died natural. That's the verdict. You can forget it. There's other things to think of now. He put his shoes side by side under the bed, took off his coat, hung it on a bed ball, took off his trousers, lay back in his pants and shirt on top of the bed.
I'm thinking, Spicer.